Accession number 27226, reel 23.
Lionel Hook, reel 23.
Yes, I told all the boys in the back, I said, whatever you do, don't get out of the truck on that side because there's water there. So they all got out on that side and climbed up the bank. Shorty Curran was driving. Jack Dyson got out and climbed up the bank, covered in concrete blocks. Such a mess, unbelievable. And Shorty Curran, for some reason best known to himself, he understood there was water there, or I must have told him, whatever, but he didn't get on that side either. And when we looked at the damage later on, that I have photographs of them, there were four lime-filled cesspits right alongside the truck, and if anybody got out on that side, somebody would have fallen into it. So that's a good start. So we climbed up to the top of the bank and went up, and thumbed a lift back to the airfield to wait for tomorrow morning to be called in front of the captain, the CO, who was also a pal of ours. He was a flyboy as well, and we were in serious trifle because that man in the car happened to be the chief of police of Mombasa. And we were told that we misbehaved something rotten. We first had to go back and get the truck back, which was still drivable, and we took a troop and went down and to look at where it was, and we saw these cesspits and we realised, you know, we'd got away with it again. And when that was over and done with, in front of the skipper, who was not best pleased to say the least, and we were due at that time to go back home. That was the end of our tour. We should have gone back, but obviously war considerations obtained, and it was unlikely that they'd let us go. But the whole operation at that moment in time was moving from East Africa to Ceylon, and in that time scale, that's when the Cade of Ishmael was sunk with all the Wrens on board, which I'll tell you about later on, all to do with this submarine as well. But we were left with a choice that, well, you can either go back home, and if you go back home, you'll be court-martialed. That's me and Jack Dyson and Shorty Curran, and the three of us have been together all that time. Or you can either go to Addo Atoll, which is in the Maldives, which was a hellhole. That was nothing there at all. It was unbelievably... And the RAF were there anyway. I believe we had walrus or something there, but they'd send us there. Or you can go on the next ship down to Ceylon, back into where you should have been in the first place. That's the Fleet Fighter Pool. Because the fighter pool, remember, was being closed down, and we were sent to Mombasa to wait. So they said, go on to Ceylon. Oh, I thought about this a little bit, and my wife never believed me from that day to this that I didn't volunteer for any of these bloody awful things that happened to me. But I said, we'll go to the Fleet Fighter Pool, please. So we're now booked on the next ship over, which takes us on to really stage next, because we are waiting for a ship to go. We had Jack Dyson and I don't think Shorty Curran had it for some reason, both been appointed to 1833 Squadron on the Illustrious with my instructor Dickie Cork, and he was killed in that flying accident, which I've probably been mentioned, and that appointment was cancelled, and that's why we're still hanging fire. But it was obviously unknown to us. We didn't know all these things. But when we got to this stage with the Nasties, with the chief of police and everything else, things had changed a little bit radically, and the war was moving that way. There was short of... The pilot movement was not that way, so they obviously took advantage, and that's why... But it gave us the option to go to Ceylon. We took the option for Ceylon. Now, in the meantime, we continued to fly... An interesting thing there was we had an engineer officer, lieutenant. Oh, I could never remember his name, Williamson. He ended up with he was a racing driver, and he was our engineer officer on the squadron. And he had never flown an aircraft in his life before, and a Spitfire had fallen off a lorry, or his case had, and they built it up and put it all together, and he wanted to fly. And Jackie Anslow, our CEO, was a pal of his, there too, you know, buddies. And he used to taxi this Spitfire around the airfield, and he knew how the engine worked and everything else. And he told him how I could fly it and everything else. And he said, we're going to fly it. And one day, while I was taxiing, he just took off and flew. First time he'd ever flown an aircraft in a Spit. I think it was a Spit. I don't think it was a Seafire. I don't know why a Spit would be there. We didn't have Seafires out there at that time anyway. No matter. It was a Spitfire of some side of kind. And he took off and flew around for an hour and came back in a perfect landing. Never flown an aircraft before in his life.
How is that possible with somebody, would you say? Just knowledge of aircraft and...
Yeah, familiarity. And he knew what the engine would do. He knew how the engine worked. He was told how an airplane flew. He probably knew a little bit more, but, you know, Jackie and they probably talked about it together. And because you can't fly a Spit with the dual control anyway. And that's the way were people learning to fly in Kenya at that time, you know, in the pre-war years. They were going into an aircraft at 2 hours flying with somebody behind a dual. If not, they'd tie an aircraft and teach themselves. You know, people don't realise this. And he got into it and flew around for an hour and came back and did a perfect landing. And a Spit is not the easiest aircraft to land in, I'll tell you. But he came in and did a perfect landing and they flew it around quite a bit. I often wondered who it was, because I told this story to so many people and they all said bullshit. But in point of fact, he had a racing car business of and old cars in Bagshot. I found his name, and I can't remember, like Williams or something, like Williams or something. Like, it was quite famous post-war, but one of these days I'll remember his name all the time. But anyway, so we're now in the situation, tooling around, fate has been designed for us, we're going by sea with the rest of the fleet, and wait your time. And ultimately, I went with my girlfriend, I know I was married, but it doesn't matter. My girlfriend at that time, she was on the same boat, and we all went over to Ceylon after the sinking of the Cade of Ishmael. Now, if our appointments hadn't been cancelled to the 1833 because of Dickie being killed, both Jack Dyson and I would have been on the Cade of Ishmael. So that in itself was a benefit. We knew there was a submarine around, and we knew nothing at all about the sinking of the Cadive at all. But it was sunk by the submarine that we've been tracing all this time, which was the best, biggest, and largest Japanese submarine, quite a famous Japanese submariner. And it had sunk the Cadive on the way over there. And that in itself is an epic story, because of the personalities involved in the destroyers. But probably we can leave that for the moment. I'll deal with it later if you want to know about it. But that really saved our lives. We didn't get on the Cade of Ishmael. We went later on. And that is something I can deal with great as an extra exercise, because we were involved from beginning to end, and I knew a lot of the history about it. And the net result was that after the war, we managed to find out a little bit about the people on board. In fact, a relative of mine called Hook, who was a girl who was with a kiddie, was married in Ceylon, and she'd gone out with a husband. I don't know the background of that story, but she was drowned and with the rest of the wrens.
So how long did your trip take from... Did you sail from Mombasa?
Sail from Mombasa. We went to the Seychelles. We went ashore in Seychelles. We stayed there. And I was amazed that, knowing all that was going on in that area at the time, that why we went into Seychelles. But it was a stopping off point anyway, pretty island, but it was just touch and go as far as we were concerned. It was merely a stopping off point, and you never questioned because you didn't know the strategy or the tactics that were going on at that time. But I've got in my logbook, I've got the Cade of Ishmael was sunk on the 12th on the 12th of February. Well, that's right. And on the 12th of February I was then flying local flying, and there was nothing. We had a radar run on a hurricane. That was a radar run on a hurricane all that time. I did a night anti-submarine patrol in February for some reason which I don't know, and then we rolled along there to Port Reeves test, local flying DBX Tanga. So we knew nothing at all about the Cade of Ishmael or anything nasty, any submarines going around. It was merely all filling in time, I think, before we set off to go someplace else. But the Cade of Ishmael was sunk on the 12th of February. And
when was the date of your trip? When did you
Well, I was in Mombasa then.
But when did you actually leave for the Seychelles and Colombo?
Well, I left for the Seychelles. Oh yes, that was the time. That was up to the 29th of February. I was still flying. I was still flying in that part of the world. I said, this is rather interesting. It's a memory. We'll again, right? I didn't leave until the end of March, the 26th of March, when a ship came in, when I went to join a 757, which is the fleet fighter pool in Ceylon, via HMT Transport Manila to Seychelles, and then an HMS Miranda, which is RAF, the race course, which is a stone frigate, really. So in that time, I arrived finally arrived in Ceylon on the 14th of April, when my destiny was sorted out sometime in the beginning of February with all the trouble with the police. In the meantime, it was just routine flying, nothing exciting. We didn't know about Dickie being killed either. That was something we didn't know. And I was just flying whatever, Ensa Party to Tanga, that's what I talked to you about. That was actually, flew them down in an albacore to Tanga and Port Reeds back, and to Tanga and Port Reeds back, and brought them back 2 days later. So that's really all the excitement there. So we can draw a blind over that and deal with our aspect
of... Let's take it on from you arriving in Ceylon then.
Yes, so we go on to Ceylon, where I joined 757, which is a fleet fighter pool, which was with Godfrey Parish, who was first the CEO of the fleet fighter pool when we went to Mackinnon Road in Kenya. So the ends are coming together again, join it quite well. So that's 757, interesting exercise. We arrived, went by ship, the Manila, which was quite an exotic tour, really, and arrived actually in the squadron in 757 and did the first flight there on the 19th of April. So we've actually lost something like four months of our working time, marking time, while the whole of the Eastern Fleet operations moved to Ceylon. And that's probably why we were stooging around, because it was partially training also the submarine, which is a bit of a thing. So we go to Ceylon. Now, Ceylon itself was a major change, because it was a tropical island and very pleasant. And we arrived there to be greeted by Godfrey and all the crowd with airplanes flying over us and everything else, and to drive up to through Ceylon, through masses of coconut palms and one thing another, quite a pleasant experience, to get to the airfield, which had just been developed, which was one runway surrounded by coconut trees, and the coconut trees were very tall. And Godfrey had just organised this place and got it going. The huts were there, and we arrived in its crude state, really. And the object of the exercise, that, believe it or not, we were training people. We were on the squadron for the input of new pilots coming in, mainly from America, New Zealanders. A lot of New Zealanders came while we're filling in time to decide where we went from there. Bearing in mind, we were at that time a bit of a problem because we'd been away for more than a naval tour, and whether we should go back home or whether we, you know, sufficient experience to go further on. And Godfrey decided, he was a very stickler for routine, and he said, "You've been away for 18 months. By June, actually," he said, "which is as long a tour as anybody does in the Navy. Do you want to go home and do the long G course, which was a promotional course anyway?" And we said, "Yes, please. We'd like to go back home. I've been married 18 months, and I'd see what my wife looked like and what she was up to." And that was okay. We flew with the squadron for a little while I was organising it, with doing aerobatics, one or two NASAs there.
What were you flying with the
fighter? There?
Yeah.
We were flying Harvard's Wildcat 5s. Harvard's is a sort of routine dual aircraft. Wildcat 5s was the main aircraft. Also had Corsairs. We had a little machine, a Reliant, for hopping around. And we also had a rather interesting Fulmer, which hadn't any batteries in, and I used to do that for all sorts of silly runs, like going to get eggs from Coimbatore Tor and all sorts of exotic food from all over the place. It was a fun squadron.
Tell me about the Wildcat, because you haven't flown the Wildcat before, had you?
No.
Had you?
Wildcat was a variation of the old Martlet, and it had a Pratt & Whitney double wasp engine, I think. Or a Wright Cyclone, one of the two. Much better aircraft than the Martlet, which was the underlying design. Bigger wheelbase, much more powerful aircraft. An excellent flying aircraft for the Navy, because you can see out of the front of it. Whereas all the other aircraft, the Corsairs had a long nose, the Seafires had a long nose. It was fast, it was solid, and when you cut the throttle, it stopped, it didn't float. So, as an aeroplane, and in the air, it flew very well. I liked it. And I flew Hellcats later on, which were a development of it. It was a good development, and when you got to the Hellcat, that was probably the ultimate naval aircraft that the Americans had. We can talk about the Corsair and its particular problems later on. But the Hellcat, which is a development of the Wildcat, which was a fighter aircraft, was much bigger, much more solid, much faster, and a really rugged naval aircraft, very good indeed. And they used it an awful lot in the Pacific. It was a workhorse of the Pacific, the fighters. We flew Corsairs as well. The Corsair was a bit of a no-no, because it was known as the bent-wing bastard for a start. A big aircraft, a long nose, longer than the Spitz. Not an easy airplane to fly. Not true. It's an easy airplane to fly, not an easy airplane to operate. I guess that's the best way to say it. Because of the nose, I think, and the size of it, it was a big airplane. But in the air, it was beautiful. It was a lovely airplane to fly. It had a solid wheelbase, so when you landed... And, of course, one of the problems with the American aircraft, and this is something I probably didn't tell you about, but... And I had this involvement with later on in peacetime, talking to somebody on the George Washington carrier, the latest ones, that they were all designed for 6'4" Texans, because if you wanted to brake, you didn't have hand brake controls. There were pedals, at differential pedals, and you had to, when you were flying them and landing and braking, you were working the brakes, in my case, and I'm not short on the leg, with the tips of your toes. And when you wanted to turn right, and you wanted to brake right as well, the pedals had gone forward, and you were doing the top, and it was very, very near the limit. So that was one of the problems, that people who were flying them, I can only speak for myself, but I could see there must have been a difficulty there, purely and simply because of the leg length and the no adjustment in the seats or anything else. But from a flying point of view, nice aircraft, no question at all.
You said use the word rugged for both the Wildcat and the Corsair.
Oh, yeah.
How can you explain that a little bit to me, what you mean by a rugged aircraft?
Well, I think the best way is to make an analogous with this, with the Seafire, which was the Spitfire, which was translated to the Navy. And they had trouble putting a hook on it for a start, because the stressing, the Seafire couldn't take the stresses of a naval aircraft, of the Navy use. Also, and this is a major, an important point, that a Seafire and a Spitfire is a beautiful aeroplane, no question at all. For the Tropsy, it was no good because it had to cool on glycol. So you're always having glycol problems, overheating if you're sitting around anywhere. But also, and this was the real nasty, it was aerodynamically so beautiful that you couldn't lose the flying speed when you're at stall. And so you have a light aircraft with a long nose coming in to land, and you've come in very close to your stalling speed, probably with two or three knots over to stall at the tail end, and you chop your throttle, and you've got to get rid of that three knots. And that meant the Buddy Seafire floated, even though it had had all the ancillary bits and pieces on it. And net result was that it floated into the barrier with a long nose. It caught the hook, and you can imagine what happened. The engine at the front went down. Stages were soaring 6 inches off the end of the propellers just to keep them going. I mean, one of the real problems, you get shock-loaded engines, people going forward, hitting a hook, going forward, the prop hits the deck, and the engine shocked as well. So that's what I mean by ruggedness. Now, if you take a Corsair, long nose, bloody nuisance, but a Corsair. If you take a Hellcat, short nose, and you come into land at, what was it, about 65 knots, I think, in those two. I think it's 65 in a Corsair. It was pretty slow, really, you know. But you came in with nose high, a lot of engine, in the right position to land, and when you chopped your throttle, the aircraft just went bonk and sat down on the deck. And when it sat down on the deck, that's the first thing, it was in 3 points. The hook would catch a wire, it couldn't come in and bounce on the deck because it was usually there anyway. And so all the shock of landing was taken by the wire and the hook and the aircraft. And the wires weren't pieces of string. I mean, they were bits of cable that cook a fair old shock. So can you imagine putting a hook onto a Spitfire, where its construction was light aluminium, really welded together, it just pulled them apart. They had an awful lot of trouble. And the classic example of what trouble you could get from a Seafire was a bloke who came into land on one of the I don't know the Dom or the Fat in a Seafire, and he bounced. Got flying speed on. Obviously, when he bounced, it probably nodded the engine forward a little bit. And it's airborne again with his wheels down. And the laddie on the barrier thought he'd be smart and think he'd get away with it and tried to drop the barrier. And he let the barrier down, the wheels caught on the top of the barrier. It went through the whole of parked aircraft on the front of the flight deck. And there was a photograph going round of one of the ratings being decapitated by the blade. His head was there and his body was in the ground, and it went straight into their park in the front and wiped a hell of a lot of aircraft off as well. That was a nasty. That was one of the problems. I mean, that's a bad example of the problems you've got from C-5, but it was not the best aircraft because it couldn't stay in the air for any time, you see.
Is that a problem, then, of adapting, really, what is a land-based fighter to carrier operations as opposed to the American ones being designed?
That it had to be designed. We always got the leftovers from the RAF, whatever we did. When we designed our own aircraft, maybe structural problems there, but they were rugged. They're more rugged. As a result, they're probably slower. Whereas the Americans always put more power in their engines. I mean, the Pratt & Whitney Overwatch and the Wright Cyclone were mighty powerful engines, the single engines, they're very, very good. And so you had that safety factor as well. I liked American aircraft, I must confess. And the Hurricane, of all the aircraft that I flew, was the nicest one to fly from my point of view. From a Spitz point of view, it was always a problem because that nose sticking out in front and the difficulty going on the ground. But apart from that, in the air, I would say that the Corsair would give the Spitz a hard time. And that's for an aircraft that weighs probably three times its weight. You know, three times the weight of a Spitz. That's my personal view. But I like them. I like the American aircraft purely and simply because of the ruggedness and the visibility. I mean, the Hellcat. All the boys who flew the Hellcat said it was the best one ever because they're no fear of coming into land, you see. When you had to land a Corsair, you didn't land it straight. You land a Hellcat straight, but a Corsair landed on a curl because you watched were coming in all the time. And then you sort of, you're in that difficult situation where at low speed on a turn, in a turn situation, that's a stall asking to happen. And you kept the aircraft purely and simply because of its power in the air with the nose up and a lot of engine and of course different technique really. I like them, but
what were you practicing with the new kind of pilots that arrived at the?
Well, they were most of them were people who come from America. That was an intake from America who had been flying Harvards. And they'd probably had probably, but I don't know. They might have gone into a working up squadron in America, but when they came to Putnam, they hadn't gone to a squadron. And I don't know quite how many had experience in flying Corsairs or any of the other Hellcats. Because the American principles were that once you flew one aircraft, you never flew anything else. If you converted and became worked up on a Corsair, you flew a Corsair forever. And the same with a Hellcat. You could work in a Hellcat in a Hellcat forever. Whereas in the Navy, if you've flown an airplane, if you've flown a Tiger Moth, the powers that be said you could fly anything, you know, and walk on water sometimes. You know, they were buggers. But there's a subtle difference, and there's a lot of, if you're in an operational situation like that, there's a lot to be said for the American principle that man flies his own aircraft. And in modern day flying in America, the pilots who are in squadrons on carriers have their own aircraft. That is their aircraft, they fly it all the time. And it takes me back to that talking about long legs and American aircraft. I went on the George Washington and were taken down by a little Texan, and he was about 5'5". He was really tiny, and he took us around the place. We all got pals, and I said, you know, he said, I can't understand it. He said, here are you flying F-18s. And I said, how can you? You're only 5 foot bugger all, can fly an American F-18 when all American aircrafts are down for 6'4" Texans, and you're on a 6'4" Texan. He said, that's my aircraft, and that cabin is custom made for me. And his one wish in life, and he's never been able to do it, and this is a bloke on the Washington, a senior Marine pilot, never been able to find a Corsair to fly. I said, if you do fly it, I said, you find it very interesting.